Okay. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the workshop Contemporary Jazz World Theory, a Legal Theory. Correspond to present the Professor Helen Froh of the University of Stockholm. The name of your presentation is Protecting Cultural Property in War. Please can start when you want.
Thank you. Thanks, and thanks to Alejandro for organizing the workshop. So the title's actually changed somewhat for reasons that'll probably become obvious. And this is part of a new project for me, thinking about how we should understand the moral status of cultural heritage and what implications that has for thinking about how we should fight wars. And of course, the destruction of cultural heritage is nothing new, but it's become kind of much more readily apparent, I guess, because of the internet and sort of greater communication, that when we that these days we are kind of presented with images of groups like ISIS destroying monuments in the Middle East, for example, and it's all over the newspapers and our TV screens in a way that it wouldn't have been previously. So we're much more aware of these kinds of acts of destruction. And there's already a fair amount of legislation, so legal conventions that cover the treatment of cultural heritage during conflict. Something like the 54 Hague Convention, for example, requires states to protect cultural sites that are under their control during a conflict and explains when it's permissible to damage a site or make use of a cultural site, and so on. But there's been a kind of growing momentum recently behind the idea that we shouldn't just think about regulating the treatment of cultural property within a conflict, but that we might also think about protecting cultural property as a just cause for intervention. And this is why I've changed the title of the talk, because as I was reading for the talk, I came across a new piece of literature exploring this idea that we might in fact invoke the protection of cultural heritage as a cause for war, and that struck me as a kind of interesting idea. So this is a piece by a guy called Thomas Weiss and Nina Connolly, which is a paper written for the J. Paul Getty Trust in the United States, in which they argue that the kind of combination of wide publicity and the generally objectionable nature of a group like ISIS has created what they call an opportunity for action. So they point out that saving cultural heritage has now come to be regarded as part of a kind of broader fight against terrorism. So these things have become kind of linked in the public consciousness. And so they say the question now is how we should best take advantage of what they describe as a kind of a useful opportunity in the sort of in international affairs. So in this paper, which they published just at the end of last year, they draw heavily on the existing doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which of course has sprung up to govern humanitarian intervention, to propose a parallel framework for understanding the international community's obligations in the face of the destruction of cultural heritage. So they suggest that we can think about the three pillars of the R2P doctrine in a way that will help us to understand when we should protect cultural heritage. So these are the sort of the three pillars that they suggest, that we would have the first claim that it's the primary responsibility of states to protect heritage in their territory. Second is that others ought to assist in building this protective capacity. And then the third is that there's an international responsibility to respond to protect heritage should the first two pillars fail. And these just correspond to the formulation that's used in the R2P doctrine for humanitarian intervention, but we just kind of substitute heritage for people, basically. Now, I want to suggest that, like a lot of people who urge the forceful protection of cultural heritage, Weiss and Connolly's account is insufficiently sensitive to a distinction between instrumental justifications for the protection of heritage, which are ultimately grounded in the protection of other moral goods, and what I'll call constitutive justifications, which focus much more on the value of the heritage itself. And I think the blurring of these two types of justification has served the end of kind of garnering support for forcefully protecting heritage. So if we think about someone like the paper by Weiss and Connolly, they're quite explicit about wanting to capitalise on the way in which people are now equating protecting heritage with stopping terrorist attacks against people. But I suggest that the proposal that we might use force to protect cultural heritage demands much more sort of substantive and independent justification than has been forthcoming so far. And that the same is actually true of even what looks like a weak claim that we should direct our resources, our non-military resources, so our money, for example, towards protecting cultural heritage. I think Weiss and Connolly's proposal belies what seems to me a really complex and genuine moral challenge that's raised by the idea that we should protect cultural heritage, and that understanding these moral challenges has to come before we start thinking about what the policy should be. So I should say that I don't really know anything about international law at all, but because what I'm really concerned with here is thinking about the kind of normative underpinnings of international law, hopefully that won't be too much of a handicap. I should also say, in fairness to Weiss and Connolly, that they do say that their paper is a starting point, although it's really long, although maybe not for lawyers. It's like 50 pages, which for a philosopher is just extravagance beyond belief, but for a lawyer maybe that's normal, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't even include the footnotes though, so 50 pages just on its own. But they say, look, this is just a starting point, and they do say this is a difficult topic. They don't say that this is a kind of polished proposal, but what I want to suggest really is that their starting point is already too advanced, and also I think their proposal lays bare some really problematic and worrying assumptions that actually, the more that I've read on this topic, I've come to think of kind of pretty pervasive problems amongst those working on in the heritage sector who have been writing on this topic. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'll start out by distinguishing these two types of justification for the protection of heritage, so instrumental versus constitutive. Then I'm going to say why I think we can't just kind of mirror the R2P doctrine for the defence of heritage, and then I'll consider the permissibility of using other resources, so non-military resources, to defend heritage. So at this stage, I'm afraid I'm very much sort of just identifying problems and stuff that we should think about rather than offering any kind of concrete solutions. But I think being clear about the kinds of issues that we need to address in order to really have a kind of a rich account of the status of cultural heritage is going to be the prior step before we can think about how we should have how we should develop our laws or our policies. So lots of people argue that threats to heritage precede threats to people, and that if we react to or if we preempt attacks to heritage, then we thereby preempt attacks on people. And so, of course, this is an empirical claim. And if it's true, then it would indeed help to justify the use of force in cases in which heritage is threatened. So I'll call this an instrumental justification for protecting heritage, because it basically says, look, by protecting heritage, we can achieve other morally important ends. And there are other types of instrumental justifications as well. So, for example, we might point to the effect of destroying heritage on, say, a country's capacity for post-war reconstruction. Or we might point to the way in which stolen artifacts are used in order to fund militia groups and so on. So there's a range of possible instrumental justifications for defending heritage. But one of the things that's noticeable about the heritage, that people working in the heritage sector, is that they don't typically claim that we ought to protect heritage only in cases in which we thereby also prevent further harms to people. Rather, much like Weiss and Connolly, they argue for much more expansive protections. These arguments are often underpinned by substantive conceptual claims about what heritage is and its relationship to people. So on this view, the destruction of heritage is itself a very serious harm to people, irrespective of whether any individual suffers further harm. So even if you sort of take out the threat of genocide and so on, the thought on this view is that merely destroying the heritage is itself to do very grave violence to people. So this kind of approach of equating with, the saving of heritage with the saving of lives is one of the ways in which proponents of these arguments have tried to diffuse the objection that they're prioritising stones over lives. And this has been a kind of a complaint that has appeared in reaction to a lot of the coverage in the media about the destruction of cultural heritage by groups like ISIS, that people in the West just care so much more about the fact that we're destroying buildings than we do about the fact that, say, there are thousands of refugees flooding out of these countries. So Weiss and Connolly argue that the protection of people and the protection of heritage are inseparable. There's no need for a hierarchy of protection because the choice between the two is false, just as a choice between people and the natural environment is false. Air, water, and culture are essential for life. A similar view expressed by Issam Kabbaj, who's a Syrian artist. This is in a recent public debate at the London School of Economics, where he said that heritage without people means nothing, people without heritage means nothing. And another claim from Vernon Rapley. So Rapley is the Director of Cultural Heritage Protection and Security at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, who suggested that people without culture is like a tree without roots. There's no point in the military going in to protect a country unless they protect the country, not just save the lives of the people. Heritage is the difference between life and living. My reaction was a bit like Victor's, which is this. Yeah, I was also on the panel and I stuck out like a sore thumb, I have to say, because everybody else is sort of nodding along saying, yes, that's all very deep. And I was just thinking, you know, you people are crazy. So that's the general thrust of my paper, basically. So it can be hard to kind of pin down what's supposed to be going on in these arguments, because they often rely on these kinds of unhelpful metaphors, like, you know, people without culture is like a tree without roots. Or they also sometimes trade on the kind of ambiguity between the meanings of certain words. So what we mean when we talk about someone's life, right? Do we mean their biological existence or their sort of biographical existence? What we mean by people, do we mean literally people or do we mean people in the sort of collective noun sense of a people? So it's clearly not the case, for example, that air and culture are on a par when it comes to what people need to survive. And these sorts of claims do very little to help us understand the moral status of heritage. So it's really worrying, I think, that this is the sort of... So the Weiss and Connolly claim is perhaps more... I mean, these are sort of things that people said in a public debate. They're worrying, but the Weiss and Connolly claim is something that's been published in a very respected, what will be a very well-read article. And it's worrying, I think, if people make these kinds of claims in what should be a kind of something that aims to illuminate the status of heritage. And you just get these sort of really sort of strange claims about stuff like air and culture are essential for life without any real attempt to sort of hash out what that might mean. So even though these arguments are kind of slippery in that respect, I think what they have in common is a claim about the constitutive role of heritage in either, say, people's lives going well, or perhaps indeed, on some views, they're having lives at all. So rather than saying that attacks on heritage are worrying primarily insofar as they're indicative of worse harms to come, so that rather than drawing this kind of connection between attacks on heritage and genocide, the claim here is more that people and heritage are kind of bound up in such a way that one can't distinguish between them, and by implication that therefore you don't need to choose between them. So on this view, attacks on heritage are attacks on people, and perhaps on some views, people's lives aren't worth living or worth saving in the absence of heritage. So on the one hand, I think that these arguments are appealing perhaps because they reflect perhaps unintentionally, what might be a plausible view about the value of heritage, which might be something along the lines of Joseph Raz's notion of derivative value. So a lot of cultural heritage, perhaps all heritage that isn't part of the natural environment, is plausibly valuable even because it contributes to human well-being, right? So there's something about the relationship between heritage and people that explains why the heritage is valuable. So the value of heritage seems to be at least in some way derived from its constitutive role in our lives going well. But on the other hand, the normative conclusions that are drawn from these arguments, I think, just don't follow. So I think what the authors are doing is kind of illicitly trading on the connection between attacks on heritage and genocide, moving then to the claim that if we defend heritage, then sometimes we kind of preempt attacks on people, to the claim that therefore defense of heritage is the defense of people, whether those people face genocide or not. And as I'll turn to in a moment, this implies that whatever's warranted for the protection of people must also be warranted for the protection of heritage. So once you have this kind of equivocation between people and heritage, that starts to make the kind of proposal that someone like Weiss and Connolly want to propose, where we just have parallel R2P doctrines for people and heritage, look more plausible than it really is, because you're no longer properly distinguishing between people and heritage. Okay, so let's think about this idea of heritage as a just cause for war. So Weiss and Connolly argue that, as we have in the original R2P doctrine, a doctrine for heritage should incorporate the possibility of military intervention. And the stipulated threshold for a just cause for humanitarian intervention in the original R2P doctrine is that there has to be a large-scale loss of life, actual or apprehended, with genocidal intent or not, which is the product either of a deliberate state action or state neglect or inability to act or a failed state situation. And so Weiss and Connolly suggest that this formulation just kind of maps onto the protection of heritage. So we should use military force to protect heritage when we face large-scale loss of cultural heritage, actual or apprehended. I can see your face again. With genocidal intent or not, which is the product of deliberate action by a state or a non-state actor, or of neglect, inability, failed state situation, or large-scale cultural cleansing, actual or apprehended.
Cultural cleansing, just like cleaning up the
genocide's not funny, Victor. They also add that military force should be deployed only in cases of profound humanitarian distress and, by extension, in cases of serious attacks on cultural heritage for itself and as a precursor for the mass atrocities that will almost certainly follow. So you can see here really clearly this kind of a leading between whether the justification for force is instrumental or constitutive, in that they include attacks on heritage with genocidal intent or not. And they also have this mention that we could defend the heritage for its own sake, for itself. So we should deploy in case of serious attacks on cultural heritage for itself, but then this is immediately followed by the claim that this will also prevent atrocities that will almost certainly follow. So this stuff gets all kind of mashed in together in a way that makes it look like this connection between protecting the heritage and preventing genocide, even though in the same kind of breath they're saying, look, even if you're not going to prevent the genocide, you should still use force to protect the heritage for its own sake. So if our concern is really the protection of heritage for the purposes of preventing atrocities, it's not clear why the current R2P doctrine that we have to prevent attacks on people wouldn't be sufficient. So as we've just seen, this doctrine already stipulates actual or apprehended large-scale loss of life is a just cause for intervention. So if there really is a robust connection between the widespread destruction of heritage and genocide, then it seems like international law already sanctions the use of force in light of the destruction of heritage. So the efforts of those people who are concerned to save heritage would be best directed towards just producing solid empirical evidence of this connection rather than drafting new norms. But As we've just seen, Weiss and Connolly propose a wider scope for the defence of heritage, to include the defence of heritage for its own sake. Now, the most obvious problem with this proposal, right, the idea that you might protect heritage, invoke protecting heritage as a just cause for military intervention, when you don't have a kind of further genocidal intent, is showing that war can be a proportionate response to the destruction of heritage. So Weiss and Connolly just assume that we can extend whatever our account of proportionality is when we're thinking about harms to human beings to understand when we might be warranted in using force to protect heritage. But we can't just grant that kind of assumption, right? So human beings and heritage are very different types of good. The fact that I can kill a person who will otherwise wrongfully kill someone else doesn't entail anything about the proportionality of using force to protect heritage. So we need much more substantive argument for this kind of claim. Something that's kind of worrying, I think, about the Weiss and Connolly proposal is that not only do they not provide this kind of account, but they don't even show any recognition that this is the kind of thing you'd need to argue for in order to get a case for defence of heritage off the ground. So the beginning of a case for invoking defence of heritage as a just cause for war is plausibly going to lie in showing that an individual can become morally liable to harm in defence of heritage. So that, for example, threatening to destroy or damage a valuable artefact can cause a person to forfeit her normal rights against being harmed. And this in turn seems to require us to show that heritage manifests the kind of value that can weigh against harm to human beings. Now, clearly not everything that's valuable to human beings or makes our lives go well is going to warrant forceful defence, let alone lethal defence. And this is true even of some things that have morally significant value. So things like relationships or promises seem to be morally significant, but it doesn't look like you can kind of kill someone who's going to break a promise, right, or use force against them. So it might be true that I can kill you if you're going to kill my spouse, but it doesn't follow that I can kill you if you're going to destroy my marriage, even if you'll do so maliciously. Even though my relationships have real moral value and they make my life go well, I mean, we can imagine that destroying my marriage would cause me financial ruin, it would cause me great distress, right? So it could be very harmful for me in various ways, but it just doesn't seem like the right type of good to warrant the use of force. And similarly, it's not obvious that heritage, even if it is a constitutive part of my well-being, is the right kind of good to justify seriously harming somebody. Now, it's kind of interesting that so far in the literature, I haven't come across any explicit defense of the view that the value of heritage itself warrants forceful defense. So what we might call a kind of intrinsic justification for force grounded in the value of the heritage itself. Rather, this claim just tends to get sort of slipped in, as in the Weiss and Connolly proposal, as a kind of a minor addition to defending heritage as part of defeating genocide or defeating terrorism. And I think in practice, probably, this case hasn't had to be made because, or at least not as a legal matter, because the focus so far has been on damage to heritage in part as part of existing conflict. So, you know, we've already got an ongoing conflict with ISIS in the Middle East. And so when you've got perpetrators of attacks who are members of a group like ISIS, international law already deems them to be legitimate targets of attack in virtue of the fact that they're members of ISIS. And so there's no need to show that they're also liable to attack in virtue of the fact they're damaging cultural heritage. So there hasn't been this kind of pressing to explain why it might be okay to kill these people, because everyone agrees under international law you can kill them already. It might also be true that when we're thinking about particular instances of damage to cultural property within an ongoing conflict, that it's possible to harm the people who are damaging the property without causing widespread collateral damage. So you might be able to just kill the members of ISIS without risking harm to anybody else, perhaps because they're damaging a site which is geographically isolated. You haven't got people living nearby, so you're not going to harm anybody else. But once we move to thinking about the defence of heritage as a cause for military intervention, right, not just something that we need to care about during an ongoing conflict, but actually might be a reason to go to war. We need an account of the permissibility of harming the perpetrators of attacks on heritage just for the sake of defending the heritage. And then once we grant this idea that harms to heritage can weigh against harms to people, it's not clear that we can restrict this to harms to culpable people, such as members of ISIS. Indeed, if we're going to argue for the defence of heritage as a cause for war, this also assumes the permissibility of inflicting collateral harms on innocent people for the sake of heritage, because wars inevitably involve inflicting collateral damage on people. And again, I don't know of any explicit defence of the claim that it might be permissible to collaterally kill civilians for the sake of defending heritage, despite the fact there are these growing calls for military intervention. Now, I'm quite sceptical that it could be permissible to intentionally or foreseeably kill a person in defence of heritage, even outside of war. So that is, even when we don't risk the escalation and the other kinds of harms of war. I can't offer a full defence of that scepticism here, partly because I don't have one. At the moment, I'm kind of dealing with sort of brute intuitions. But I'll briefly indicate some reasons why I have this kind of scepticism. So a central reason applies to instances of heritage that are valued on religious grounds. And this is basically just because all religious beliefs are reasonably contested, and lots of these beliefs are incompatible. So lots of people believe either that there is no God or that other people believe in the wrong one. So that means we can kind of work out a priori that the majority of objects that are taken to have religious significance are valued on mistaken grounds. And it's hard to see how values that are grounded in beliefs that we know are likely false could form the justifications of a basis for harming people, at least seriously harming them. So we don't normally take the defence of mere objects to warrant significant force. So it might be that I can use some kind of limited force against you if, say, you're trying to smash up my car or steal my wallet or something like that. But we don't tend to think that I can use serious harm against you. It looks disproportionate to, say, kill you if you're smashing up my car. Now, those people who are advocating the lethal defence of heritage, especially as a cause for war, owe us a robust account of why the value that we confer on certain objects, often on mistaken factual grounds, could generate permissions to do harm. Now, more generally, I think we should also remember that preventing the destruction of artefacts is often not a neutral act. It can also serve an effect to prioritise some beliefs over others. So we've seen this in with respect to various secular artefacts, such as, say, the Confederate statues in the United States. So there's been a big debate over whether we should tear these statues down or whether we should keep them, or whether they should keep them. And there's a kind of a default conservatism with regards to cultural artefacts. So we tend to treat things which are old or decorative or historic or of religious significance as being kind of almost sort of by definition worthy of respect. Our default attitude towards these things is that we ought to respect them. And yet clearly many such artefacts are culturally divisive, and favouring the preservation of an artefact requires justification. And this seems especially hard to provide when the object is divisive on religious grounds. So if we think about something like the Confederate statues, most of us will probably think, well, look, we can give good arguments for why slavery was wrong that most people will accept. And this is going to support the idea that having these statues is objectionable, right? They might not be decisive arguments, but it's not as if there's going to be a reasonable contesting of the idea that slavery was evil. But it's hard to give similar arguments in support of the view that, say, God either does or doesn't like certain objects. So taking the preservation of certain idols as a kind of moral default, right, the idea that it's wrong to destroy certain religious icons, well, they're offensive to one group and not offensive to another. And it's not like we can give sort of similar arguments where we say, look, we think God's more likely to approve of the preservation of these artifacts rather than their destruction. It's just not clear what that sort of argument would look like, because we don't really have any evidence one way or the other. We should also note as well that the mere fact that somebody might be willing to risk their life for the sake of cultural property doesn't show that it has value that can count in a justification for harming. So this is a kind of theme that crops up a lot when people say, when you express scepticism about the idea that you can sort of think that a human life could be sacrificed for the sake of cultural heritage. And people say, well, people do that all the time, right? People do sacrifice themselves. There's kind of stories of heroism of people, curators of museums and so on, really trying to protect the cultural heritage that they have under their protection in the face of attacks by groups like ISIS. But the fact that somebody's prepared to die for a cause doesn't show that the cause is valuable, right? We can think of lots of examples where people blow themselves up for really kind of morally bankrupt causes. And even if it's true that you are permitted to sacrifice yourself on the basis of things that you mistakenly or otherwise take to be valuable, this doesn't show that you can cause harm to other people for the sake of those things. So even if we think that when we take cases like the Monuments Men, so these very famous cases of people risking their lives in order to rescue sort of these stolen treasures from the Nazis, it didn't. The fact that they were prepared to risk their own lives didn't confer on them permissions to kill other people, any more than the fact that you might be willing to risk your life for your own child doesn't mean that you're allowed to kill somebody else for the sake of your own child. So these are just some of the kind of the initial difficulties with making the case for using force for defending heritage. But I think it's also worth considering what probably seems like a much less contentious part of Weiss and Connolly's proposal, which is that states ought to support, that is, financially fund, the protection of heritage in other countries. So, Weiss and Connolly have a kind of a fairly cursory reference to what they call the optics of intervening to protect heritage when lives are at risk, but they actually say very little about the moral dilemmas we might face when we're deciding how to direct our resources. And part of their discussion also suggests what strikes me as a kind of worrying inversion of priorities. So they say that, taken seriously, the imperative to prevent damage to heritage also requires massive investment in international development to alleviate poverty, income and wealth inequalities, a lack of democratic representation, and other root causes that feed into political instability, conflict, and eventually the destruction of cultural heritage. So this seems like a very strange way to think about the reasons we have for alleviating poverty and trying to sort of do away with inequality and tyranny. Right, so these things seem to be the real imperatives, or at least imperatives in themselves, rather than just mere means to protecting heritage. And so when you see this kind of language in a serious proposal for how we ought to draft laws for the protection of heritage, it's really not surprising that people living in these countries feel like we're prioritising stones over lives, because it's sort of there in black and white that the reasons we have to alleviate poverty is that we can protect cultural heritage. And that's just a bizarre view about how we should care about these things and how we should weigh them against each other. Now, I don't think that means that it's impermissible to spend our resources protecting heritage, but we do need some explanation of when and why it's permissible to do so, given that we've got finite resources and money that we spend on heritage is necessarily money that we're not set spending on saving lives more directly, at least, so say by curing disease or trying to alleviate poverty. So a lot, I think, depends in this case on who's doing the spending. So I think it's plausibly permissible for individuals to choose to direct some of their own resources towards cultural heritage protection, at least if you're a non-consequentialist. So non-consequentialists believe that once we as individuals have discharged our duties to aid, we're allowed to use our remaining resources to pursue our own interests. So I can go and buy records or go to the theatre, even though those resources could save lives if I directed them towards poverty alleviation. Now, if it's permissible for individuals to sometimes pursue their own interests in art or records or whatever at the expense of saving lives, it seems like it must be permissible for somebody to fund the protection of cultural heritage rather than, say, funding shelter for Syrian refugees. Now, importantly, this permissibility doesn't seem to depend on claims about the relative importance of, say, saving artifacts compared to saving lives, or the value of artifacts compared to the value of Syrian refugees, any more than the permissibility of buying records seems to rely on me being able to show that it's more important that I buy records than I save lives, or that the value of the records is somehow greater than the value of people's lives. So the non-consequentialist claim is that Individuals who've discharged their duties to aid are permitted to pursue their own interests, even if doing so is less morally important than other things one might do. But thinking about what individuals may do doesn't seem to answer the question of what governments can do. Sorry, I'm not very good at doing the PowerPoint. There we go. All right, so I think on the contrary, perhaps it gives us some reason to think that governments aren't allowed to direct their resources towards cultural heritage protection. So individuals are free to use their resources to pursue their own ends only once they've discharged their duties to aid. Now, most people at least partly discharge their duties to aid through taxation. And this means that the government, that the money that the government has in their foreign aid budget, for example, isn't money that can be spent pursuing cultural interests of the sort that individuals are free to pursue with their surplus resources. Rather, this is money that has to be used for aiding, and therefore, plausibly, it's money that should be used to minimise harm. So this claim that we ought to minimise harm when we're aiding is the claim that underpins the effective altruism movement that many of you are probably familiar with, which holds, for example, that ordinarily it's wrong to donate to, say, anything but the most efficient charity. So it would be wrong if you're going to give $100 to charity to give it to a charity that would use it to save 10 lives when another charity would have used it to save 20 lives. Now, effective altruists think that this is true even when you're not under a duty to aid to begin with. So even if you're making an optional donation, it would still be wrong to deliberately donate the money to where it would do less good. But even the weaker claim that resources that we're obliged to give should be directed to where they do the most good seems to challenge the permissibility of using money from a government aid budget, say, to protect heritage. To justify diverting our resources in this way, we'd have to show that saving heritage does the most good compared to our available alternatives. And when those alternatives include curing disease and alleviating poverty, it's hard to see how saving heritage could be justified. So I think, despite what a lot of people working in the heritage sector suggest, we can't avoid pitting humans against heritage, given this background of human resources. I mean, several philosophers, including Victor, have argued that the duty to minimise harm when aiding challenges the permissibility of interventionist wars across the board, because it's almost always going to be the case that you could do more good with your resources if you just use them, say, to alleviate poverty and cure disease, rather than waging an interventionist war, because wars are massively costly in ways that curing disease just isn't. So far from broadening our causes for war, it might be that we should really be thinking about encouraging governments to explore non-military means of doing good, although I think it's unlikely that that's going to be focused on things like protecting heritage rather than alleviating poverty and curing disease. Okay, so I guess the headline takeaway from this is that I think this stuff is hard. Much harder than people like Weiss and Connolly and those working in heritage more widely have been willing to acknowledge. And it raises really deep and difficult philosophical questions about value, about commensurability, that we can't just kind of solve by applying a framework like the R2P framework, which was designed to prevent physical harms to people by causing physical harms to other people, basically. We can't really just sort of transfer that notion of proportionality to something like the protection of buildings and protection of artifacts. So insofar as the instrumental justifications for protecting heritage are sound, it might be that attacks on heritage should be prevented in light of there being kind of harbingers of worse things to come. Now, these kinds of arguments are still vulnerable to all of the familiar objections to humanitarian intervention, so the risk of escalation, collateral harm, the lack of a reasonable prospect of success. But of course, you know, in principle, it seems like it is better to prevent these, to preempt these kinds of harms, like you want to preempt a genocide rather than just react after it's begun. But the persistent and kind of pervasive conflating of these sorts of instrumental justifications with claims about protecting heritage for its own sake is doing little to illuminate the moral status of heritage. And even the seemingly milder claims about using non-military means to protect heritage aren't straightforwardly true, So a lot depends here on the nature and the scope of our duties to aid, and in turn, on how our governments may fulfil those duties on our behalf. So I think that the danger here of caring more about stones than lives is much more than just to worry about kind of optics, right? It's a genuine moral complaint from those who are being told that their lives are not worth saving unless we also save their heritage, and that without their heritage they're nothing, and these kinds of things. And I think this is the kind of complaint that we really need to take seriously as we develop any sort of policy for the protection of heritage. Thank you.